It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as we begin the program, just to remind you, don't hesitate to give them a call. As a matter of fact, I would strongly recommend just doing so to give yourself an opportunity to find out about the services offered. And I might also mention, they will give you some very good advice even in the process. So call them, Harvell and Collins. And by the way, go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. And their number, 252 area code 726-9050. And with that introduction, Cecil, Wes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Lockwood. Here we are, Lockwood. So, Lockwood, we have spoken quite a few times, Wes and I, on the program about the statutory support in the state of North Carolina, not only case law, but also through statute, of the spouse in North Carolina, the husband or wife. You must be married, but if you get that certificate of marriage in the state of North Carolina, then any number of laws begin, statutory and case law, begin to apply to the institution of marriage. And we've talked about, you know, deeds between a husband and wife. Even if the deed doesn't say that the property is joint, if at the time that that deed was put on record, it mentions both the parties, the husband and the wife, even though it doesn't say they're married, if they are married at the time that the deed becomes operative, then there's a presumption, again, one of the many laws that presumes that the parties intended that property to be joint. And therefore, if one of them dies, it goes immediately to the surviving spouse. Now, that's just one example, Lockwood, but there are just so many examples. From a tax perspective, there's what's known as the unlimited marital deduction. You can leave an unlimited amount of resource to your spouse, and there would be no tax on that inheritance. And so the spouse in North Carolina stands in a very superior position to be able to take a share of the estate of their deceased wife or husband. And there is in North Carolina a very direct statute known as the elective share statute that then outlines specifically what that percentage must be. So in other words, this happens every day in our office that folks will come in. Sometimes it's the first marriage. A lot of times it's the second marriage or third marriage. And they do not think it's necessary to leave assets to their spouse. In a second marriage, they make the comment that, well, my wife already has her assets and I have mine, and we want them to go to our respective children. Or in a first marriage, sometimes you might hear, well, my wife, you know, is from a very wealthy family, and I want my assets to go right on down to my children. And so any number of facts can be presented, pieces of the puzzle to Wes and myself, whereby the issue comes up. But guess what? There is a statutory right in North Carolina to a percentage. And unless that is waived through a prenuptial or a postnuptial agreement, then that statute is going to apply, and your spouse would be able to elect a share of your estate, notwithstanding a last will and testament or trust that excludes or limits the inheritance to your spouse. We've talked about this before, but today I'm going to let Wes kind of begin with the procedure, because we have a number of files in our office where we are in the throes of an elective share, where we have elected a share, or we have and have filed for it, or we are defending, if you will, against a filing of an elective share. And so Wes is going to tell us the deadline, the statutory deadline, and then where it's filed and how it's filed, and kind of the mechanics of the statute. We've talked before about the statute existing, and I think our listeners have heard that before, and you have certainly heard it, Lockwood. Right. But let's today kind of move to the mechanics of how it gets applied?
So, yes, Lockwood, certainly we have spoken about the elective share and some of these moving parts with regard to the rights of a surviving spouse or even the rights of spouse during life. I mean, you know, even the, you know, Cecil was talking about some of the rights that you have from a tax perspective as a spouse. Also, when we're dealing with Medicaid, we're dealing with adult Medicaid services, spouses can transfer assets back and forth without any penalty, without that 3 or 5 year look back period that we've most people have heard about. Now there's a catch 22 with regard to that, that is probably more appropriate for another program. There's just so many different areas where folks we find are very often unaware of the rights of the spouse until they become aware of it, and many times there's a failure to plan, and we're helping them through that process. So as it relates to the elective share itself, the time period is very short for filing that. It's 6 months from the qualification. So when we have a situation where someone has passed away, there's a surviving spouse, there's an estate open, and then there's qualification of the personal representative. This is the person that applies to the clerk of court to serve as the fiduciary, the person who's going to push the estate through and handle all of the requirements by statute of the administration of the estate. You have to file that elective share within 6 months of that period of time. So it's in the world of what we do, normally we're dealing with things like 3 year statute limitations, right, sometimes shorter, sometimes longer, but a 6 month period of time is a relatively short period of time in the world of, you know, making a decision as to whether an elective share is going to be filed for, is going to be petitioned for. What that looks like, though, is when you file it, obviously you need to file it in the right place. You need to make sure that the filing for the elective share is proper. It meets all the requirements. And in the event it's defective in some way, then there you could put yourself in a position where there's an argument that there was a failure to properly file an elective share claim. And if it's defective in some way within that 6 month period of time, if we're beyond the 6 months, then we can't fix it. So that's very important to make sure it's proper. So obviously the person who's filing that elective share claim would be the surviving spouse, because that's, as we've indicated, a prerequisite. This is a spousal right. This is not a girlfriend right or a boyfriend right or any other right based on relationship, a child right. This is a surviving spouse right. And this could be the, you know, the first marriage, mm-hmm, or the 10th marriage. It's just, right, who are you married to at the time of the death. So the filing of that elective share claim is made with the clerk of court where the county, in the county in which the estate is pending. Mm-hmm. So when that will is put on record, accepted into probate, or if it's an intestate estate passing without a will, and then there's a qualification of a personal representative, then that's when the clock starts to tick as far as the 6 months goes. Now, once that is filed before the clerk of court, then there's a relatively short period of time that the estate, through its administrator, executor, personal representative, all synonymous terms, is required to file with the court basically a breakdown of all of the assets that would be considered for calculating the elective share of the surviving spouse. I think I'm sitting here without the statute book in front of me. I think it's a 2 month period of time after the filing. That's off the top of my head, maybe three, but I think it's a 2 month period of time where there's a requirement for the executor to come forth and to provide that information. Obviously, the intent there of our General Assembly in putting that relatively short time frame and that requirement and that onus on the personal representative is that we would like to avoid the elective share process from being adversarial so much. it's inherently adversarial because we have a surviving spouse exercising his or her rights to basically take assets from the estate, and that means those assets coming from the estate, those assets are coming out of someone's pocket. So obviously that kind of inherently leads us down a path of an adversarial nature. But the requirement of the personal representative to file the appropriate documentation so that there's transparency, so we know what the assets are, so we know what life insurance policies there were, so we know what gifts there were in the last year, what transfers of assets out of the estate that would that have to be clawed back in. We know it's a little easier to determine what real estate there is because we would be able to do a title search.
Right.
What bank accounts there were, what personal property there was, what jewelry there was. You know, it can go on and on and on. And the net that is cast as it relates to the elective share is a very broad net. It is not just assets that pass under the probate estate, like under a will.
Mm-hmm.
It also includes assets that pass by beneficiary designation, by joint with right of survivorship, by payable on death through a beneficiary or even a life insurance. So it really captures everything. And the intent there is to ensure that the surviving spouse is taken care of. And there is a kind of a breakdown percentage-wise as it relates to how much the surviving spouse would be entitled to of the elective share. Up to 5 years, is, I believe that number is 15%. Then we go to 25 at 5 to 10. 10 to 15, it's a third. Over 15 years of marriage is 50%. Anything above that is 50%. So it is based on the length of time that the individuals were married. Now, in the event that they are separated, not living together,
mm-hmm.
living not under the same roof, they've decided, hey, we're married, but it didn't work out, but who wants to go through the headache of divorce? Well, let's just agree to agree. We're just not going to be together. You know, your stuff is your stuff, and my stuff is my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if one of those two individuals in that situation dies, doesn't really matter what the agreement was. The surviving spouse would have that elective share claim unless they have an actual proper waiver of that in, as we've heard before, a prenuptial agreement, and that would have been before the marriage, or a postnuptial agreement that actually properly, technically, with the appropriate language, with all the bells and whistles, waives that elective share claim.
Back to this issue of elective shares and the aspect of the rights, the spousal rights. In the case of a will, and I am probably jumping ahead, and I apologize, as opposed to a prenuptial agreement. In the case of a will, does a will in any way contribute to, enhance, or in some way reflect upon this issue of elective shares?
It does. It does. And I want to come back to that because I got you asked a great question right in the middle
okay.
of my giving bad legal instruction.
Okay.
I didn't finish what I was saying.
Yeah.
It kind of gives me heartburn. You can be living separate and apart. The presumption is there's still the right to bring the elective share. But if those are the circumstances, there is a defense of abandonment that can be raised.
Oh, really?
Okay, right. So in the event that there is that scenario where they're living separate apart, then, you know, the state could raise abandonment. You abandon, and by your actions of abandoning the marriage, that would be a defense against the elective share.
Okay.
Now, as it relates to the will, so yes, we have had cases before where the individual has stated in the will, the person who died, I don't want to leave my spouse anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that in and of itself does not affect the right for the surviving spouse to bring an elective share claim. Of course it doesn't. That would make no sense whatsoever, because the purpose here is to survive, is to protect the surviving spouse. Even if the relationship is bad. I mean, you know, we could have a situation where, you know, for example, the husband was, you know, the breadwinner and built up everything in his name during a 15-20 year period of time, and the spouse took care of it, the wife took care of everything else. She took care of, you know, the home and the bill paying and the kids and the taking to school and everything else. Well, it doesn't make any sense that our law would, the law would allow the husband to just entirely disinherit her after she has contributed to his ability to build this wealth. So even if their relationship fell apart and the husband under this scenario says, I don't want to, you know, she's a, you know what, I don't want to leave her anything. Well, it doesn't matter. She still has that right to bring that elective share. Now, whatever is left to the surviving spouse offsets the amount that the surviving spouse receives through the elective share. So if the house, for example, the marital home is tenanted by entirety, and it goes to the elective, it goes to the surviving spouse under the elective share claim, well, that half the value of that house goes into her column as something she's received to reduce the amount that she would otherwise receive under the elective share claim. If she received life insurance, that reduces it. If an account was left to her with beneficiary by beneficiary designation or joint right of survivorship, that would reduce the claim. If the car was left to her, yes, that would reduce the claim. So it's an exercise in calculation and math once we have a complete picture as to all of the probate and non-probate assets, once we understand when the marriage took place, once we understand how many years the marriage existed, it's a matter of simply calculating that, but also taking into consideration how much that surviving spouse received upon the death. So you can imagine that while we, and I think the intent here is to make, you know, the elective share claim is very, you know, very process oriented and non-adversarial, you can imagine that these situations do unfortunately become adversarial. And where they primarily come at become adversarial would be, and I think primarily two areas. Number one, a situation where the estate is not as forthcoming and transparent as it should be, with it's required to be with regard to the identification of assets that go into the calculation.
Right.
That would be one area. And then we get into the right of doing discovery, sending subpoenas, you know, finding out really what those assets were, transfers that may have taken place within a year of death, those type things. And then the second area is valuation. Lockwood, it's not that difficult to get pretty close on the value of, let's say, real property, because we have professionals who can do that.
Right.
We can get appraisals. It's not that hard to get close to the value of personal items, such as, I mean, we can get appraisals on jewelry, gold, diamonds. We can get appraisals, and, you know, obviously we have services online with regard to vehicles, those kind of things. But when we get into, for example, a closely held business, let's say that, or any kind of business really, and we're looking at tax returns, we're looking at the revenue of the business, we're looking at the balance sheet and the assets of that business. Sometimes there could be quite a dispute with regard to what the true fair market value of that business is. And if that business, let's say it's the husband's business, he leaves that business and his 100% ownership interest in that business through his estate plan to his, let's say, his children who have been working in the business, just to pass it on to the next generation. Well, and maybe the wife wasn't involved in the business at all. Well,
still,
that total value of that business, it comes into the fold for calculating what she is entitled to under the elective share. Now, is that business, you know, does it have, you know, 25 employees and it's worth $5 million? Or is it, you know, does it have two employees and it's worth $100,000? Or maybe it has 25 employees and maybe it's worth $15 million. Mm-hmm. That can be a very subjective determination. So you can imagine that once we get into those kind of things, there often is more protracted and extensive litigation that involves experts, business valuation experts, discovery with regard to tax returns, with regard to you know, the QuickBooks, ledgers with regard to how the money has been spent through this business over the years, you know, that these kind of things, depositions maybe of folks involved in the business. So you can imagine it really opens up into something that becomes, you know, more contentious as opposed to just valuing things and, you know, or applying to it a mathematical formula. It can get into that. Yeah.
We're talking, of course, that's Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. Wes, on the aspect of elective shares, you know, one would assume automatically that in the case of a long-term marriage and the death of a spouse, that it just automatically all the assets would go to the surviving spouse. Is that an appropriate assumption, or this whole mm-hmm. issue of elective shares, does this kick in? Mm-hmm. In other words, for the beneficiary of the children of the mm-hmm. marriage, that sort of thing. That's what I'm kind of wondering on that.
Lockwood, let me respond to that a moment. That's just such a common misunderstanding. Okay. And that is an enormous assumption. And we know what we all say about making assumptions.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
You cannot assume. It is not accurate that assets automatically pass to a spouse.
Okay.
I cannot tell you how many files I have on a weekly basis where folks tell me, well, I just thought that the asset had one just yesterday. You know, the house was in the wife's name. She died. She had it before they got married, and they've been married for 25 years, and he just assumed uh-huh. that the house would pass on over to him. Now she has children from a prior marriage. That house does not pass exclusively to the husband just because they were married. So here's the bottom line. Assets do not pass automatically to your spouse. That is a wrong assumption. There are many assets, depending on the way in which they're titled, depending on the way in which there might be a beneficiary or a joint account, possibly they do. But you cannot just blanketly state that just because we are married, we therefore inherit everything from each other. Your lawyer has to check behind the titling of the assets. That's the second stage to any good estate planning file, and verify that the titling of the assets are consistent with the estate plan. Now, I know that we're somewhat out of time. I would like Wes and I to both remember, and you help us, Lockwood, because we're so busy during a week. But next week, let's continue this.
There are some
other nuances here that we run into at our law firm about who files this. You know, what if your surviving spouse is elderly and infirm,
uh-huh.
but yet has the power of attorney to a child?
can a child file this elective share on behalf of their elder parent? We have had several files like that in our office. And then the titling. One thing that I don't know that we've made as clear as we need to is that when we are analyzing these cases, Wes alluded to it, but we have to, it's not, it's, you know, you have to look at all of the assets, the IRA, the 401k, the life insurance, the business, as Wes was mentioning. Every single asset is brought into the formula. A lot of people are under, again, making an assumption that, well, it's only, you know, the things that we that pass according to the will, like maybe the bank account or the or an investment property or something of that nature. But any asset passing to the surviving spouse under any scenarios, even a trust, assets that are not titled but are titled in the name of a trust are all brought into the formula. And this, again, Wes, don't you agree, this would be something that we could go into next week because there are a lot of nuances here, Lockwood.
You know, and that's Cecil Harvell, Harvell and Collins, and we were talking earlier about this with Wes Collins, as a matter of fact. To both of you, a real quick comment and a compliment. You know, the assumption is, all right, we've got our will, we've got it all planned out, we don't have to worry about a thing. But as you've just pointed out, Cecil, there are so many nuances. We need to, and the issue of elective shares, something that we very seldom hear anything about. Obviously, you two do in your capacity as legal representatives for those survivors. But this is an important issue, one that obviously, if we take care of our paperwork in advance, we eliminate a lot of, and something you mentioned earlier, Wes, the adversarial situations that might occur. And, of course, that has an emotional drain as well. So I think that's an important issue. So next week, we'll just take on then, as you just pointed out, Cecil, a lot of assumptions. I think this is a very important conversation. I do want to remind the audience, please do not hesitate to give a call to their office, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. I guarantee you, as you are hearing today, you will be glad you did. That's Harvell and Collins. Again, that website, harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, Harvell and Collins. With that, Cecil, Wes, thanks very much for your time today.
Okay. Thank you, Lockwood.